Because of listeners like you, Preborn has helped to rescue over 67,000 babies. Your $28 to sponsor one ultrasound doubled a baby's chance at life. Your tax-deductible gift saves lives. Please join us in this mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.
Jenna Ellis in the morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our creator, not our government. I believe that scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the morning.
Good morning. Good morning. It is Thursday, June 5th, and everyone on Capitol Hill is talking about the One Big Beautiful Bill and whether or not it actually is a beautiful bill or whether or not it's a one big ugly bill, as former Representative Bob Good has put it. And there is, of course, some tension between Elon Musk coming out disfavoring the bill versus Donald Trump, who hasn't actually specifically openly opposed Elon's rhetoric, has gone more after Rand Paul, Thomas Massie, and a few others who have been kind of doggedly suggesting that this is way too much spending. It's not actually codifying DOGE, but the House Republicans did receive an official request to codify DOGE cuts. And so the Speaker, Speaker Johnson, released a statement, it looks like on Tuesday, to confirm the White House received, or the House rather, received the Trump administration's rescissions request to cut $9.4 billion in wasteful spending identified by DOGE. So now that the White House has sent that long awaited spending cuts request to Congress, what is going on with this bill that is now being sent to the Senate? Senator Mike Lee has suggested that it was flawed and that it's the Senate's job to help fix that. But let's welcome in Representative Tom Tiffany from the great state of Wisconsin. And Representative, thanks so much for joining. Can you help us kind of figure out where we're at with this one big beautiful mess?
Well, surprise, surprise, Jenna. Lots of rhetoric coming from Washington, D.C.
Imagine that. That's never been a headline.
yeah, for sure. So it is accurate. You know, I think about my home state senator, Senator Johnson, who has been all over the media talking about how this bill has to get better, as you alluded to, Senator Mike Lee saying the same thing. And all I say is go, Ron, go. If he can make this bill more conservative, he can reduce spending, please go at it and get it done. I voted for the bill as it came out of the House. I think there's a lot of good stuff in there between securing the border, permitting reform, things like that. I mean, it is so important. If we're going to bring inflation down, we have to have abundant, affordable, reliable energy sources. And one of the things that's been holding us up is the permitting process. We have some good permitting reform that's in the bill. So there's lots of good things in the bill. Could have it cut more? Yes. I would say those of us in the Freedom Caucus, we did everything we could to make the bill better at the end. We were able to get some significant concessions, especially in regards to what they refer to as the Inflation Reduction Act, which, of course, was the green fantasy. President Trump and others call it the green new scam. I call it the green fantasy, where wind and solar are getting subsidies up to $50,000 an acre from federal taxpayers. And we were able to really pare that back to when the bill is passed, you have to have 5% of the project done within 60 days or you're not going to get the subsidy. And that cuts the price tag about in half, because it's about $1 trillion now for what the Biden administration did a couple years ago with the Inflation Reduction Act. And it cuts it about in half, which was really, I thought, a significant win. I think they should all go away. And if the Senate can do that, terrific. The other part is Medicaid. And we did get the work requirements in there. There's more that can be done. We're incentivizing states like California to add people to their rolls by giving them 90% with the Medicaid expansion. And they've got a line item of $9 billion for illegal aliens in the California state budget. And you see that across other states also. So there's plenty of opportunity in the Senate. I hope they're successful at that. I just hope that they don't backslide.
Well, and so so with voting yes on this, and that's, you know, good to know that you're standing by that. Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene posted on X, and this went pretty viral, that she said, "Full transparency, I didn't know about this section on pages 278, 279 of the One Big Beautiful Bill that strips states of the right to make laws or regulate AI for 10 years. She goes kind of into detail about this and reducing federal power and preserving state power. So she's adamantly opposed to this. It's a violation of states' rights and would not, I would have voted no if I'd known this was in there." And so that, you know, that's just one aspect. And I think this, in my opinion, evidences why we need to have single issue bills, because this was kind of massive. But that's just one instance of things that now several members of Congress are going back and saying, well, wait a minute, if this had been a little different, we would have voted on it. Is there anything in that that you agree with that shouldn't have been in there?
I haven't. So I think it's a really good example that you give there in regards to AI. As far if the question is, are there other items in there that I see now that should be removed? I was really focused on the whole Medicaid and green fantasy stuff because that's where the real money is. And that's where we need structural reform because otherwise those programs continue with a permanent life. And that's what sucks so much money out of taxpayers and has driven us $36 trillion in debt. I was really focused on trying to get to the structural stuff in Medicaid, in the wind and solar scam that's being foisted on the American people, and because that's where the real money is, Janet. Now, if there's other stuff, I sure hope that the Senate takes a good hard look at these things, and if they find something along those lines, that'd be terrific. Make the changes and send it back to us.
And so speaking of, you know, finding some of these things, I mean, this has also been one of the complaints, I think, from a lot of members of Congress that so much of this legislation that is so massive is pushed through and the vote comes to the floor before you as members have really had an opportunity to kind of go through it with a fine tooth comb and have, you know, your staff go through it and really digest it all. Is this something that you think there should have been more time to be able to identify some of these things before it passed and was sent to the Senate?
You never like to see stuff that goes through and people say, okay, gosh, I wish I would have noticed this. But remember, there are others that saw it and they agreed with it. I mean, let's take this AI example and discuss it. So think about it. If we say that states should be able to regulate AI, and maybe there's a good case to be made for that. Remember what we just did with the Congressional Review Act, where we took away the power of California to regulate tailpipe emissions because what they were trying to do was end the internal combustion engine in California. That has a ripple effect across the entire country. So what was going on there is California was putting in place a regulation that was going to harm the rest of America. There's a parallel there with the AI. I think that there could be some changes to the AI provision there. Should it be done in the way Marjorie Taylor Greene is saying? I don't know that, but maybe you could perhaps have a right of judicial action by the states or something like that. But there's a reason why sometimes you don't want the states to have this unfettered control. And the tailpipe emissions example is a really good one because that was going to harm the rest of America and via a law in California. So I think these things really need to be thought through thoroughly. And maybe that's the point that people are making here, Jenna. And so the Senate should take a good hard look at this AI provision and any others they find and do a good review of them before they send it back to the House, the bill back to the House.
And I'm speaking with Representative Tom Tiffany from the great state of Wisconsin. And, you know, going back to kind of this this request from the White House for the long-awaited spending cuts, How is this request or this package known as the rescissions on Capitol Hill, how is that not part of the one big beautiful bill? I mean, why weren't these things done jointly, and is there a reason for that?
Yeah, rescissions, we can only deal with mandatory spending, whereas rescissions is discretionary spending. So there are rules that are set up around reconciliation that we couldn't do the DOGE cuts because it's the rules are simply different. Now, I'm so glad that the White House has sent us a rescissions package, and I hope it's the one of many. I'm hoping that we're going to see at least one a month or one every couple weeks now to codify what DOGE has found, because DOGE can't simply eliminate that spending. They can identify that frivolous or wasteful spending, but it's up to Congress to get rid of it, and it's time for us to take that vote. I'm hoping next week that we will take the vote on the first rescissions package and that we will do our job and end that spending that has been so wasteful and has led to the debt that we have here in America, and hopefully it's the first of many. And by the way, there are other means of us going about it. I'm hoping that the Big Beautiful Bill is just the first step. We also have the rescissions package. We have another appropriations bill that's coming up because the next fiscal year starts October 1st. That's another opportunity. And then we can do another reconciliation bill in 2026. This should be the first of a number of opportunities for this Congress to end or reduce the waste, fraud, and abuse that we see in our federal government.
And so with this rescission package, this is likely targeting the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and some of the federal budget that provides public funding for NPR and PBS. And as you're aware, for those in our audience who haven't heard this yet, of the NPR and a couple of other broadcasting agencies out of Colorado that are suing the Trump administration for that executive order that would eliminate the federal funds. I mean, this obviously coming from Congress would basically moot out, I think, that litigation, because then it would override and essentially codify an executive order. And so how big of a target is that in terms of the rescission package?
Yeah, so your characterization is accurate. And public broadcasting is simply a partisan broadcaster at this point. And so if you're going to be that way, then get your money from individual people. Don't go to the taxpayers. Why should a taxpayer who disagrees with their viewpoint, why should they have to fund a broadcasting outlet like that? And so I'm hopeful that next week we do have the votes. I'm not sure. I have to talk to leadership about that. But it's time for public broadcasting to stand on its own, especially when it's such a highly partisan organization, as we saw by the statements that were made by the woman who is the head of public broadcasting.
Yeah, and I think, Representative Tiffany, I mean, it seems like there's no such thing anymore, really, as public broadcasting, because every outlet, I mean, conservative media as well. I mean, certainly on this show, I make no qualms about the fact that I have a viewpoint on things. And that's, I think, why a lot of listeners tune in, is to hear the perspective and the biblical worldview and, you know, all of those things from a conservative perspective. But this isn't public broadcasting. I'm not pretending otherwise. And for those like NPR and PBS, it seems like there really is no such thing anymore in our modern media as truly just public broadcasting that's just the facts, fully informative, no perspective or bias anymore.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what you see with this government funding, and we've seen it with DOGE, we've seen it in the variety of ways in which the swamp has been exposed. If you do not spout a certain narrative, you will not get funded. You know, whether it's people like Stacey Abrams getting $20 billion in a grant from the EPA or, you know, public broadcasting. It's time to end that. Let the American people make the choice of how their money is going to be spent. Don't force them to have to spend money on something that they do not agree with.
Yeah, well, well said. Well, we have to take a break here, but Representative Tom Tiffany, thank you so much for always dropping by. It's always wonderful to have your insights and viewpoints from Capitol Hill, and we are praying for you and all of your colleagues there in the House as well as in the Senate, and hoping that our leaders make good decisions for the future of this country, for the budget, for all of this spending package and everything that we're dealing with as the American people are recognizing, you know, we have a huge debt deficit that we have to do something about. And so as the debate continues, we will see what the Senate comes up with and continue to talk about it here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. We'll be right back with more.
The month of June has been hijacked by the anti-Christian culture to show their pride in something God calls an abomination. When you support AFR, you help us continue to stand for godly values and provide the resources for you to stay in the know about the enemy's tactics. To say thank you for your gift this month, we'll give you the booklet, Inside the LGBTQ Push of the 1990s, to help strengthen your convictions. Just go to afr.net/offers. afr.net/offers.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, according to our good friend Orrin McIntyre, who is a host and columnist at The Blaze, yesterday, Real Chris Rufo, who those of you especially in Florida know through a lot of his great work kind of eradicating the woke, asked why we should repeal the Civil Rights Act. Well, there's a lot of good reasons for that. But another X account titled Academic Agent dropped a bombshell report, and this is according to Orrin, about a secretive agency with the job of silencing Americans and covering up anti-white violence. So let's talk about the Community Relations Service, and let's welcome in Orrin McIntyre. So, Orrin, I read through this entire thread, and listeners can go to Orrin McIntyre, and that's your X handle, and read this entire thread, and I won't kind of spoil it for you to go into, but the Community Relations Service, or the CRS, was formed under Title X of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. I had no idea that this existed. And so this is a really fascinating thread. Unpack it for us.
So in the 1964 Civil Rights Act, Title X created or required the creation of this agency, the Community Relations Service. And ostensibly, the plan was to have this service that went around and smoothed out race relations between different groups, which sounds reasonable. Excuse me. But unfortunately, like most government programs, it continued to grow and its mission continued to warp, and very quickly became an organization that wasn't about smoothing out these problems, but completely covering them up and lying to the public about them. So the CRS has this incredible level of mystery around it. They actually have a confidentiality privilege that allows them to basically be on par with the FBI. They're all but immune to Freedom of Information Act requests. They can use that privilege in congressional hearings and before judges, and they have done so in the past. And there's clear evidence that the CRS has been involved in all kinds of wild stuff, from training left-wing activists to controlling and guiding race riots. They've been involved in forcing grieving families of crime victims to go out and give forced statements to try to play down any given tension. They've gone in and controlled local media, threatening to pull their FCC licenses if they're not willing to hire the right people or peddle the right stories. It's a wild thing that this existed, and it was actually already on the Trump administration's radar. But the hope is that this goes moves the impetus from just defunding this organization to completely removing it.
And this is really wild. And why are we just now hearing about this from people like, you know, you and Chris Rufo and others, when clearly if this has been going on since 1964 and the inception of the Civil Rights Act, why hasn't this been at the fore of some conservatives trying to eliminate the funding for it sooner?
It's a great question. Part of it, again, has to be its level of secrecy. It was so hard to get hold of much of this information for a long time. This is an organization that even destroys its own notes. Almost nothing it does is actually entered in to the public record. So it's very difficult to get any background information. But the nice thing is that these guys were so proud of what they were doing that some of them actually went out and wrote a book about it. So a lot of this information comes straight from the horse's mouth. They would have gotten away from it or with it if they hadn't been so confident in their actions, but they have been involved in all kinds of nefarious things. They were working with the disciples of Saul Alinsky in the 1960s. They were actively working to downplay or cover up the murders of white Americans by minorities. They were actively working to control riots, to guide them, to allow them to happen, but make sure they didn't go too far and anger the rest of the population so that there would be consequences. This is a theme throughout, and one of the nastiest things we have seen them being involved in, again, is the coercion of the families of victims, making sure that they say exactly what the agency wants them to say, with the idea that, oh, well, what we're doing is managing the community response, but what they're actually doing is forcing people to lie on behalf of a particular narrative. These are people who have been involved in forcing the planting of mosques in Christian communities and all kinds of stuff that, you know, the average American would find absolutely vile, but it's being done with their tax dollars in secrecy.
Wow. And this is this is just incredible. And one of the things in your thread says that the CRA is basically immune to the Freedom of Information Act requests. And so is that part of the reason why this has been so secret? I mean, are we aware of any FOIA requests that have basically been denied or just almost pocket vetoed, essentially, before the book came out and before we knew more about this just in the public domain?
Yeah, again, it's not an organization that received a whole high level of scrutiny previously, but yes, the FOIA request basically can only get basic things like travel receipts and that kind of thing. You can't get any information out of them, and that's specifically because of Title 10 of the Civil Rights Act. It's designed to give them that level of cover. And we're talking about an organization, for instance, that was involved with what happened in Lewiston, Maine, where one man was killed by two Somali immigrants, and his family was basically stage managed by this organization to try to downplay any kind of tension inside the community. Now, the reason that the CRS was already on the ground and ready to manage this the minute it happened was because the CRS had been there while they were actively settling Somalis in that community, expecting that there would be tension and even violence. So they knew that the refugee resettlement that they were involved in was likely going to spark some kind of conflict, and they were already there trying to manipulate local media and the people on the ground in case something like this happened, in case there was Somali-on-American violence, so that they would already know what to do. So this is an organization that is constantly concerned about backlash when there's two government programs that are already violating the lives and rights of Americans. So they knew they were doing something bad, and they deployed this team to be prepared in case the inevitable happened. And then when it did, they forced this victim's family to give the correct response and to hope that there would be no backlash to the government problem of resettlement.
Insane. And you know, the CRS, according to your thread, also set up Operation Rumor Control, which still operates to this day. And your thread goes on to say, Rumor Control manipulates local media sources to control reporting on the damage done during riots and downplay the role of civil rights leaders in instigating them. The CRS is responsible for stage managing the entire Trayvon Martin incident, including parading the family before Congress, carefully managing protests in Sanford, Florida, training activists, and astroturfing progressive organizations like Dream Defenders. The CRS was critical in increasing the effectiveness of movements like BLM. I mean, this sounds literally like the old, was it 1980s, maybe even 70s film, Wag the Dog? I mean, this literally sounds like that.
Yeah, this is when you start to realize that a large amount of the civil rights revolution that eventually became wokeness was managed top down by the government. As you pointed out, we have Operation Rumor Control, which is designed to control the media at a local level, be able to manipulate given storylines. We have the Marshall Training Program, which is basically the CRS's way to train left-wing activists on the government dime. Much like USAID, the deeper you go, the more you realize that this entire organization is not neutral. It doesn't exist to serve the American people. It is specifically a political wing. It was an organization designed from the very beginning with a political agenda, and it is using American tax dollars to basically implement leftist policies as if it is some kind of super secretive, but also very benevolent civil rights organization. That is just not the case. This is very clearly a leftist organization that Bragg, the authors of the book, one of the guys who founded the organization, Bertrand Levine, he bragged that the mission of the organization was to break up lily white towns and treat them to have the right type of diversity. So this has obviously been the agenda for a very long time. The Operation Rumor Control has existed since the late 1960s, and like you said, continues to this day. So this is just something that should not exist. And luckily, I was contacted by the Trump administration. They have already worked into the new budget that was released in May the defunding of this organization. Now, obviously, defunding is fantastic. It keeps the organization from doing anything while the Trump administration is there. But anything that is defunded can obviously be refunded unless the organization is eliminated. However, because of the way it's structured and required in Title 10 of the 1964 CRA, you would either need to amend or repeal that in order to actually remove this organization from existence.
So it could maybe just be a shell operation. But is it possible then, if it's not funded by Congress, to get outside funding to continue its operations if it statutorily is required to exist?
That's a great question, and I do not know the answers to that one. I don't know if they would have the ability to seek that funding elsewhere if it's no longer part of the congressional budget, or if it simply folds up because it doesn't receive any funding. I was asking the administration official on that. They said that the defunding should make it impossible for them to do anything, but statutorily it does have to exist. And so the only actual way to ensure that it's either doesn't get other funding or isn't able to be resurrected the next time Democrats get elected is, again, to remove that statutory requirement one way or another.
Yeah, and this whole idea of just repealing not just the portion that deals with the CRS or the Community Relations Service, but repealing the entire Civil Rights Act. I mean, obviously, if we're talking about something like that, then, the left goes into histrionics and is saying, oh, well, then, you don't care about equality and, blah, 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 whatever. But a lot of the Civil Rights Act in 1964, what we've seen through the iterations and I think the abuse of the original intent by that Congress of the Civil Rights Act has been making civil rights the only rights that they want us to believe our Constitution speaks to. So essentially they're transforming liberty rights and natural rights that come from God, our creator, not our government. They're trying to transform those rights into merely civil rights to push their notion of equality and foist that onto not only Americans through statutes and state law, but especially through judicial decisions. And we saw that very clearly in the Bostock opinion, for example, that read into the 1964 Act the definition of sex being sexual orientation and gender identity, or SOGI. And so I think there's a lot of problems that not even at the time of its inception, that now, 50 years later, or 60 years later, we're seeing the problem with that language. And so I would agree that repealing it is a good first step. But of course, there will be campaigns against this and the left. I mean, we would be taking a huge weapon out of their arsenal. So how practical is this in terms of actually happening when we have a Congress that's, pretty weak and isn't up for that kind of fight likely?
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think ultimately, Christopher Caldwell wrote a great book called Age of Entitlement that argued that the Civil Rights Act, while it was meant, it was created with good intentions, it was eventually took over so many of the rights in the United States that it's essentially become our second constitution. And we simply can't have something like that operating. It is very difficult, as you point out, politically to repeal, because obviously most people just hear Civil Rights Act and they think, oh, everyone should be equal, which is, of course, what you actually want. But it's not what the Civil Rights Act does today, because it's been warped and stretched so many times, as you point out. Things like disparate impact are just insane, and people don't even realize what they do. That's their law of America is just absolutely nuts. The best thing we can do, I think, is what the Trump administration has already started to do, which is defund things like the CRS and put someone like Carmen Dillon in charge, because she's over there running the Civil Rights Office as if it actually wants everyone to be equal, which is something that many have not done previously. Unfortunately, you can't keep that in, you know, forever, but that's a personnel change. If you lose an election, then you lose those changes as well. So long term, we're going to have to deal with the fact that unless we actually are willing to pay the political price to repeal something like the Civil Rights Act, we're going to continue to have this problem. And you know what? Roe versus Wade was politically unfeasible, and then it wasn't, right? So I think that this is something that is on the same level. It is as big a mountain to climb, but I think it's necessary to climb it, because if we're actually conservatives, if we actually believe that smaller government is better and we believe that America isn't a racist country, then we don't need this giant top-down KGB-style mind control organization operating inside the United States. Americans aren't going back to Jim Crow. This isn't that kind of country anymore, and we don't need a bunch of legislation and a bunch of government power trying to stop it. The HR stuff, the woke stuff, all of that existed in corporate America and major American institutions because of the Civil Rights Act. Those HR departments are required because of the Civil Rights Act. The Civil Rights Act is the vehicle by which wokeness entered into our political bloodstream. And if we want to get rid of that, then getting rid of the thing that allowed it to exist in the first place, I think it's pretty critical.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're absolutely right that even just a few years ago, we had the Democrats screaming that Roe versus Wade was super precedent and cemented in the law of the land and all of that. But when Republicans actually get it together, and conservatives overall, there are things that we can fix and correct. And this is one of them, absolutely. And not to obviously take away the definition of the American dream in terms of protecting immutable characteristics like race and gender. And yes, there are only two genders, but doing that in a way that the left can't manipulate and would be a better way moving forward. So Orrin McIntyre, a really fascinating segment. Thanks so much for coming on. You can follow him at Orrin McIntyre, and we will be right back with more. This June 24th marks 3 years since Roe v. Wade was overturned. But here's what you may not know. Abortion numbers have surged to a 10-year high. The battleground has shifted from the courtroom to our homes. Today, over 60% of abortions happen through the abortion pill, taken in silence and often alone. Preborn Network clinics are standing in the gap, meeting women in their most desperate hour. And here's what they're seeing. Young mothers, terrified and misled, are delivering their babies, tiny, perfectly formed, onto bathroom floors. These precious babies, once called just tissue, now are lifeless. 11% of these women who take the abortion pill will suffer serious health complications. Countless others carry emotional scars for a lifetime. When you give to Preborn, you're not just saving a baby, you're saving a mother as well. You're giving her hope, financial support, and the truth. Preborn has already rescued over 350,000 babies, but there are so many more who need our help. Your tax-deductible gift makes this mission possible. To donate now, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or go to preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Well, Democrat Governor Katie Hobbs of Arizona is ripped as a quote-unquote total disgrace after vetoing a bill limiting Chinese land ownership near military bases. Hobbs called the vetoed bill ineffective and said it could lead to arbitrary enforcement of land purchase restrictions. That story in Fox News yesterday. And Congressman Andy Biggs, who is from the great state of Arizona, Arizona District 5, and is also running for governor as the Trump-endorsed candidate, posted this on X. There is no excuse for Katie Hobbs to veto a bill that prohibits the Chinese Communist Party, the CCP, from buying Arizona land. As governor, I'll work with the state legislature to get this bill immediately signed into law to protect Arizonans and our military assets. So Congressman Biggs joins me now. And this makes sense to me because I live in the free state of Florida, where it was several years ago that our governor, Governor DeSantis, signed a similar bill. And this just makes sense that a foreign government should not be able to own any of our land. So what is Katie Hobbs thinking?
Well, Jen, it's hard to tell what she's thinking. I mean, she's had kind of a word salad, right? I mean, it could make some arbitrary kind of land sale restrictions. Well, this isn't arbitrary. It isn't like China and the CCP is not an adversary to us. I mean, we just yesterday they arrested two scientists for bringing terrorist, agro-terrorist products into the country. So, I mean, and Arizona is an interesting place because you've got two major dams. You've got the Glen Canyon Dam and the Hoover Dam, plus a whole host of other dams that give hydropower and water. You've got multiple military facilities there where we do massive training. We control drone flights around the world from some of our bases. I mean, we train our allies there in Arizona. It's just mind-boggling, Jenna, that she can sit there hermitized on the ninth floor of the Capitol building there and basically say we're not gonna have any restrictions on the CCP coming in buying land.
Yeah, it's really wild. And according to this Fox News piece, they report that Chinese investment in land, particularly near military bases, has become an increasing concern for national security. And the Senate Majority Leader in Arizona is now in efforts to get the now vetoed bill passed and cited recent Chinese attempts to lease buildings alongside Arizona's Luke Air Force Base, where the military trains fighter pilots. I mean, this doesn't seem like it should be in any way, shape, or form a partisan issue. And yet, almost at every turn, it seems like a Democrat, either lawmakers or executives, choose the least America first path possible. And that is a huge detriment, not just to the people of the state of Arizona in this instance, but overall, I think this is a national security concern for the rest of America.
100%, Jenna. I mean, first of all, no Democrat voted for this bill in the House or the Senate in Arizona, and then the governor vetoed it. But it is anti-national security. It is anti-America. But this is the same governor who, we can't be surprised, because she also, when she first got in, she took away barriers that were on the border that had been placed by the previous governor. She disbanded the Border Security Task Force. Those types of things, when we're at the leading fentanyl smuggling, most of the fentanyl coming into the country was coming through Arizona at the time, still is, and human trafficking, we were the number one human trafficking corridor in the country, which meant in the entire world then, and she got rid of that Border Security Task Force. This is basically putting some kind of political dogma above the safety and security of Arizonans and the rest of the country.
Wow. And, you know, we're seeing the effects of, you know, the consequences of elections. And Katie Hobbs follows two Republican prior governors in Arizona, Governor Doug Ducey and Governor Jan Brewer. And you're running against Katie Hobbs, who's up for re-election next year for governor. And so this is, you know, one very major example of a shift and a difference in worldview and policy between Democrats and Republicans. What else have you seen from just her administration that you would like to change for the future of Arizona?
The way she's mismanaged the budget, the way she's attacked the educational choice that we have. Arizona's the leader in the country in educational choice, but she's attacked that. We had a great election integrity bill following after Florida, Jenna. We were going to basically impose Florida's law, which actually is, you remember the hanging chads from the early 2000s, and now all of a sudden a state with 20 million plus people is able to get their election results on election night, and the state with 7.5 million people in Arizona, we can't get ours for 3 weeks to 4 weeks afterwards. So we were going to be going with Florida, but she vetoed that as well. You know, her water policy. We've got cities that cannot build a single family home in them because of her water policies that she's imposed in Arizona. It's just basically she's a hard left Marxist type of ideology, and it's basically derailed and misdirected Arizona. It's time to get Arizona back.
Wow. And, you know, and you mentioned the election integrity bill, and, you know, that Florida did really clean things up after the 2000 election. And one of the things I recall from 2022 and Abe Hameda's race for attorney general, and that was really close. I mean, it was under 400 votes, the margin of difference, and just getting a lot of the data in order to mount legal challenges or, you know, some of those objections was really hard. And so that, I think, is a huge facet of this in Arizona and, you know, in all other states as well, to at least allow for candidates who may have a legal challenge or a contest to be able to get the data from the counties and the election districts so that they can see what actually happened.
Well, that's exactly right. And so you need to get back to some precinct voting. You need to provide the data to the candidates at both before, during, and after the election so you can assess the election in and of itself. Maybe you have a challenge, maybe you don't. But what happens in Maricopa County, which is the biggest county in the state, people ask me constantly, they say, well, Andy, we think you're going to win, but what do we do about election integrity? Well, I just have to remind them, we're going to have to make it too big to rig like President Trump did in Arizona. He won by 180,000 votes, which was remarkable, the biggest of all the swing states in the country. And so we can do it, but in order to change permanently to make sure we have election integrity, we need to get a Republican governor with a Republican legislature. And that's one of the first things that I'm going to be doing is signing that bill.
And I'm speaking with Representative Andy Biggs, who is a Republican candidate for governor in Arizona, and will challenge a current governor, Katie Hobbs, in her reelection effort. And so for those who are in Arizona who, you know, may not be paying attention as closely to the local politics, and of course, you know, this is a national program for people who are looking at Arizona, kind of wondering, you know, what makes this a swing state? Because obviously in the 2020 election, that was a big state that there was an emphasis on. You mentioned, you know, President Trump won it in 2024. By that wide of a margin, but what is the local kind of outlook and the demographic there that makes this a swing state, and how are conservatives trying to get that more over to the right?
Well, we've had such a migration into Arizona from California and from places like Illinois as well, that it's kind of had an impact on our elections. I mean, so the reality is we're still a red state. We have a 350,000 registered voter edge for Republicans, but we also, so it's 35% are Republicans, 33% are independents, and then the balance are Democrats. So we have a tremendous advantage numerically, but sometimes our independents break to the left a little bit. Although different places they're breaking to the right, but what helps us and what will help us is the fact that we get a better turnout. And, you know, you have like places like Turning Point USA and Arizona Free Enterprise, all these groups that are now well organized to get people out to vote. That's how I think President Trump won, is the bringing in those swing voters. But here's the deal. California has had an out-migration of over 8 million people in the last 10 years. And a lot of those people ended up in Arizona. A lot of them went beyond us into Texas, but and into Utah and Idaho. But the reality is we need to make sure that they're not turning Arizona into California. Arizona has a long history of Republicanism, fierce independence, rugged individualism, that type of thing. And we need to make sure that we hold on to that and we take care of those bread and butter issues, the economy, safety, border security, the things that Arizonans count on as they live their lives. They want to be able to just live their lives. It's a beautiful state. They want to be able to live, grow, work, play in the state. We need to make sure they can do that.
Yeah, and you mentioned, you know, all of these people who are migrating from California because they're just so over and frustrated with the insane leftist policies that have really ruined an otherwise beautiful state in California. And yet when they leave and they come to places like Arizona or Texas or even here in Florida, it's amazing that they don't then leave the policies behind and somehow don't make that correlation and connection to say, oh, the reason that I'm leaving California is because of the bad policy. And so maybe I need to vote for better policy. And maybe that means more conservative policy. That means America First policy. How do we educate those people and connect those dots for the masses that really want to leave the leftism and the things that don't work behind?
Well, we have to be constantly teaching. I mean, you're exactly right. When I go speak to the companies that come in, I tell them, I said, thanks for being here. Why are you here? You're here because it's a better lifestyle, newer infrastructure. It's cheaper to buy a house, housing, all of these things that make Arizona a more easy, commodious place to live. Here's the deal. Don't vote to turn us into California. And you vote to turn us into California when you vote for lawmakers who are going to give you policies that are not dissimilar from California. So if you're going to vote for somebody who basically is a defund the policer, you got a problem. If you're going to vote for somebody who says we're going to go to net zero energy within 15 years, you got a problem because you're giving us all of California's policies again, all the regulations that go with it that made it unlivable in California. And quite frankly, California is unlivable right now. And so it's constant education, constant informing, and actually giving real-world examples. You know, like you talk to people, you got a 1,200 square foot home in California that's going for $1 million, and that same house is going for, a third of that price in Arizona. So you got to be able to lay that on them so they can see very clearly what's going on.
And I'm speaking with Congressman Andy Biggs, who is also the Trump-endorsed candidate for governor of Arizona. You can follow him on X at Andy Biggs for the number 4AZ, Andy Biggs 4AZ. And before I let you go, sir, I want to get your take as well on this controversy with the One Big Beautiful Bill there in Capitol Hill, since you are still there representing Arizona's District 5. What is your take on this controversy between, Elon and the Rand Pauls, Thomas Massey's versus, Trump and those who are supporting the One Big Beautiful Bill?
Well, I think what's going to happen, first of all, I thought the timing is kind of odd that Elon Musk wasn't saying this before the bill passed out of the House. You know what I mean? Because there were people, and like myself, we're trying to get more and more reductions in spending because we do have a spending problem. That's our biggest problem. I think it's going to get resolved. I talk to senators on a regular basis. They're trying to make the bill better as far as the spending reductions go, and they want to move towards a balance. They want to build this, bend the spending deficit curve down, which is the right thing to do, and they're fighting on that. And I think President Trump's very amenable to that. I think President Trump wants to get to a balanced budget, and so we're having to do all of that. But don't forget, if you didn't get moving with this, you're not going to get your the tax plan going forward. And you had to get that, because without that, then you have a massive tax increase on top of everything else. And we can't afford that as a country as well. Plus, I would say contextually, there's some other things that are important. Number one, there's a substantial increase in the projection for growth by the Atlanta Fed. So that's good. There's the tariff notion. Now we didn't really want to get into that, but that's going to offset, according to CBO, $3 trillion or something like that of that national national debt. So if that happens, you start paying for stuff, and then with the reductions that you're going, you might actually have a chance to bend that spending arc down if you do so. I think it's going to really be good for the economy and help us going forward.
All right. Well, Congressman Andy Biggs, thanks. And great point. You know, if Elon had these concerns, it seems like he should have raised them before Congress had finalized and voted on this bill. But we'll see if the Senate makes any changes. But I always appreciate you joining. You can follow me next at Andy Biggs 4AZ. And as always, you can reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
Preborn's whole mission is to rescue babies from abortion and lead their families to Christ. Last year, Preborn's network of clinics saw 8,900 mothers come to Christ. Please join us in this life-saving mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.